for the repairs on the cars.
Cocksuckers around here, you know, all that sort of thing. Yeah.
Do you remember one time Carl got drunk?
Yeah.
And he ran down when he traded his truck off for that old Pontiac. Who owned that Pontiac? Was it Howard Klamer?
I don't know who owned it. I don't know. I never would know.
Well, it was Howard Klamer, I believe, that owned this old Pontiac sedan. And Carl had an old International truck.
Yeah.
When he went to work for the union, he had no use for the truck and he needed a car. And Carl and I were working partners at that time. And we got this old car.
What year was that?
1934. The fall of 34.
You mean after the strike?
After the strike. Ray Rainbolt and Tommy Williams is running a bootleg joint on 3rd Avenue.
Yeah, that's right.
And Ray, you were organizing for the party.
Yeah.
And the offices were up on 3rd Avenue South, 631,
yeah.
I believe.
Right. 631, yeah.
And Al Russell was in the CCC camps that fall.
Well, I was working the unemployed.
That's right. Yeah. And you were working for the party.
Yeah.
And Mickey Dunn was down for the gas workers in St. Louis, Laclede County Gas Workers.
That's right.
He was conducting that long strike down there in St. Louis.
Yeah.
And Carl and I were working together because Carl didn't know the transfer men.
No.
And Harry DeBoer was still laid up from having his leg shot out.
Yeah.
And I forget who was working with Frozik. And we were the staff of the union at the time.
Mm.
And so one day Carl ran over a semaphore. They used to have them in the center of the road then. Stop and go signs is what they were.
Carl Skoglund did.
Carl Skoglund.
Yeah.
And he ran over this thing, and these things were collapsible.
Yeah.
They weren't rigid. And they'd lay down, and then after you run over them, they'd pop back up again.
Yeah.
Well, when Carl ran over it, he hit a dead center, and it raked the pan of the old thing, and it sprung a leak, and Carl was blind drunk, and the oil ran out, and he had to have new rods put in it. And George Dreon put the rods and everything in, and he put in a big bill. Oh, he had a bill that was donkey's years long. It was a foot and a half long. Every cotter key and everything was all for a rib on Skoggy, you know. So Farrell sits there in the staff meeting that morning and says, well, we've got a bill here for
$72.
I don't know how many, a scandalous sum at them days. $50 was all the one in the world. And this was a big mountainous figure. He says, Carl, we'll pay this bill. We urge you to be more prudent in your driving. Well, this was for repairs of the crankcase and the rods and everything. We says, how did this happen? Carl twisted his eyes. He says, the truck backed into me.
Oh, Scully.
Oh, Jesus, there were some days.
Last time he was here, he was sitting right where you are.
Yeah?
Yeah, he was sitting here. We were having some.
I had him in my house for a week when he came to Seattle.
Yeah, we had a lot of fun with him.
You know, Ray, I called up. I knew Carl was here. I found out about it, rather.
What year was he here? The last time.
His last trip to the coast was 14 years ago.
No, it wasn't that long, Ray.
Not quite that long?
No, it wasn't that long, because...
That's right.
It would be after 57.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
It was closer 59, in my opinion.
Yeah.
1959.
Yeah, you must be wrong, right? Yeah.
1959? 1959?
I would say give a year or two either way, and I'd agree. I don't know.
It was after 57.
I'm not good on those kind of dates.
But
I remember he came through, and he was the first time he'd been west for a long
time. Well, that's
long
the first
while.
Time they let released him out
that's
of that
right.
scandalous.
Get away.
That's right. They kept and him in New York. They wouldn't let
went,
him out of New
he
York.
He went and he told me the first time I ever heard of him, though. He used to be a Skoggie when we were expelled. He used to be a member of the. He had great admiration for Foster, but he liked Jim Cannon's politics, you see.
Uh-huh.
And he was always watching Foster, you know. And when we were expelled and Cannon took the lead, and then he said. That's why I've been hesitating all these years, he said. Vincent, I wonder if Foster goes bad, he said, who can lead us anymore? And he said, Cannon has got the stuff. He shows it by taking on the whole goddamn Third International, and it was still an international then, you know, under Stalin. And he said, Cannon is the only man that can lead us now. That was his way of saying that he had finished with Foster completely. He always had, and Foster was a great union organizer, no question about that, you know. And that's what he admired greatly, but he suspected of not being a political man.
Foster was the leader of the
CP.
But he was the leader of the big steel strike,
1919. Well, he organized the packing house workers, and he organized the steel workers, the biggest strike they ever had, under Gompers.
Yeah.
Yeah, under Gompers. And he was working for Gompers. Yeah. And his record is very shaky on the question of any political, a real loyalty to the political movement. And that was always a question in the ranks of the. We had a block with the Foster Caucus a lot of times. The Cannon faction and the Foster faction used to make a block against Lovestone or some of these others, you know. And Carl never went along with the Foster Caucus on those kind of things. But he still liked Foster very much, you know. Foster came through, you know, in 1938. He was the first one sent over because he was running for president. And we spoke, I was running for senator on the communist ticket at that time. Jim didn't come back until several weeks later.
28, you mean, not 36?
28.
It was 28? I thought it was in 26.
28. And they had the Lovestoneites were in charge of the party. So they had him surrounded in New York, took him off the boat, off the ship, put him on a train, and sent him to Minneapolis first. On his way to Butte, and then to the coast, you know, and he made the swing around the south and came back to New York. And so we were the first ones that saw him. The New York people didn't see. He didn't speak in New York. He was going to speak there in his final, you know, running for president. So we came through, and they had us. I was supposed to be one of the speakers ahead of Foster. I was merely running for senator, and they had two or three other guys running for other posts, so that we went on first. And they set Foster far away from us as they could. Scogel was on the platform too, being one of the old timers and so forth. He wasn't running country. So I was called to speak, you know, went around back of the other speakers on the program, went to the lectern, gave my speech, and when I got through, I stopped at Foster's chair and put my arm around his neck and said, "We'd like to see you, you know." He said, "You and Scogie," and you couldn't hear, he didn't move his lips on me, "You and Scogie in the station," he said, "go in the office with me." And we had 30 minutes to go over there. We went down through the bottom and climbed into this. Scogie and I knew all the ways around the Union, around the Union Station and all that stuff. We found him in his car. He told us, he said, "I'll be waiting for you to come through the train." So I told Scogie, and when the meeting broke up, the Lovestoneites surrounded Foster, you know, they were going to take him out for a bite and get into his train as quick as they possibly could, leaving. And we were scared that they were going to come down on the runway, you know. But they decided not to for some reason.
He probably discouraged them.
Well, he did his best. And they didn't, I think, they didn't realize that we were going down there, I'm sure. So we got on the train. We knew how to get on the train.
Well, Carl had been working for Pullman. Carl knew his
way. I know. We both knew the thing very well. And so we started one way. He started one way, and I started the other to look at Foster, see. And I ran across him first. So we walked back part way and got into a vacant seat in one of the Pullmans. And Foster came in and told us, he said, "What happened in the 6th Congress? That's what we want to know." So he said, "Well, we haven't got much time," he said. And he said, "There's a big fight in the international, big fight in the Russian party." And he said, "The thing you two comrades should know," he said, "the thing that I want to tell you now," he said, "it's a struggle between Trotsky and and Stalin. No. And he said, Trotsky has the program. Don't forget that ever. He said, Trotsky has the program, but Stalin has the power. And he dwelt on this at length, going over. And he said, it's impossible, he said, to go into all the details in these few minutes. He said, I just want you to remember that. And he went through, that's all we got from him, virtually all we got. And he went back, when he got back to New York, he was the one and with the turn and supported Stalin with the love sonites and threw us out. Now he did it knowing deliberately that Trotsky had the right program, but Stalin had the power.
He succumbed to power.
I bet he never did. I bet he never did anything politically important after that either.
No, he didn't. He didn't.
That was his end.
No, he became a prisoner of the
Love Sonites. Of course. Once you do that, right?
Of course. Yeah.
There's no way out.
No.
Once you swear allegiance to a man, you're going to wear his colors.
That's right.
The legal expression is singing for your supper.
Yeah, that's right.
The Southern Negroes have an expression. Once they get the collar on you, the muzzle isn't far behind.
That's right. Well, he knew that very well. Yeah. He was no dope, Foster.
Made a choice.
Mm-hmm. Well, the English workers have a saying, too. He's cake I eat, his song I sing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he didn't intimate to us who he was for, but he emphasized, he said, you must know, and don't ever forget it, he said.
Trotsky has a program, but Stalin has the power.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know, I was to get back to Skokie. When I called here, where's Skokie? And Ruth says, we just now put him on the train. We're just back from the depot. Just got in the door.
We sent him up to Seattle.
Sent him to Seattle. She told me what train it was. So when the train arrives in Seattle, I shake myself down there, you know.
Uh-huh.
I'm standing behind the stanchion, and here comes Carl looking around, you know. I reached around and I grabbed him on the shoulder, you know. I said, what are you doing here? He turned around and he looked at me, and only partner fell over. He was the least person in the world, and he thought that he'd bump into me under those circumstances. He said, how do you know I was coming? And I says, Carl, you know I'm from Minneapolis. He says, yes, I know about that. Well, I said, I've got a big snooze box tracking device on my roof. And I says, I just like a radar control, I says, and it started getting closer and closer, and I said, when the snooze started getting sloppy, I knew there's only one guy it could be, that's you. And I come down here, I says, it led me right to you. And I wouldn't tell him, you know, who told me. And every once in a while, they try to knock me off base and says, how do you find out I was on that train, Brother Yak? And I said, I said, Carl, that snooze you chew, I says, anyone's ever been associated with you? Hmm? God, one night we were up to that, where was that place we used to go fishing there where Grant and Mickey used to go, and Jewel, and Fent, up there at Crow Wing Lake.
Yeah. Who's Fent?
His brother, Fent.
That's my youngest brother.
Yeah.
And,
he's one of the two that's left.
Yeah. Fent was standing bar at the Union.
Yeah.
Where's Fenton now?
He's in Minneapolis.
He's Minneapolis. Still got the grocery store, right?
No.
No, he's out of there now. That's the last time I talked with you.
Yeah.
Was out in his grocery store.
He was never active in politics.
Yeah.
No, he's active in the Union.
Oh.
Oh, yeah. He was the guy that used to get the big beef from the Armour Brothers, Armour Boys.
Yeah.
Yeah, he knew every Armour packing house driver. And they used to find a way of just throwing a half of a steer, you know, into another wagon or truck or some goddamn thing they'd have there.
Was that during the strike?
During the strike, sure.
When you needed food.
Yeah. Yeah, he stole more meat from the armor's packing house company. It was in contact with the armor drivers at the time.
Yeah.
They were not out, you know.
He had that Loring grocery for a long while down on Loring.
Yeah.
Because I worked for that Loring transfer for that Roy Evans.
Yeah. Well, like all the mom and papa stores, he had to get out of there. That's all he and his wife. You know.
Well, the apartment house district changed there. When that was a heavy apartment house district, then it was a paying thing.
Well, but these big
chains moved in.
Chains were moving in.
But even like in this city, the mom and pop grocery store survive here
in New York. Every city.
Yeah.
What was the name of that fall?
Pretty badly weeded out, I'll tell you.
What was the name of that the trucker that you were talking about that had you made him get the money in the middle of the night?
Fay Watson of Omaha, Nebraska, owned a Watson Brothers Trucking Company.
And he got the money at what time in the morning?
About 2 o'clock in the morning. He said, "Where'll I get the money?" Farrell says, "It's not my business to get money." He says, "My money, my job here is to get satisfaction for the men." He says, "You get the money. If you can't get it tonight," he says, "we'll accommodate you tomorrow. Then you'll have plenty of time to hustle it up. Go get your banker out of bed."
Well, that's a good idea, you know. If he closed down his trucking outfit, then he has plenty of time to talk.
Well, then they got all the time in the world to devote to the interests of the men. They don't have no problems of business. Because business is ground to a screeching halt.
Yeah.
I remember one of the first times we really used that to an advantage. And that was, by Jesus, I just remarked about him. Cliff Hall was in the act. Do you remember?
Yeah.
The old local 500 down at the Star, when we took the Star drivers over? And the head of the Cowles publication, that's Look and everything.
Yeah.
They come in. They were going to show these little country bumpkins how to do business.
They have to.
Yeah, they have now. But them days they didn't. Yeah. We showed them a few tricks.
Yeah, that's right.
So we tied them up. They were famous for their sports release.
They were only, at that time, they were only millionaire newspaper owners.
Yeah, from Des Moines.
And their wealth didn't come from the newspapers. They have $50 to $75 million of liquid stuff that doesn't even touch their papers. And how much more, nobody knows. But they were in Des Moines, Iowa. That was their base.
Des Moines Register.
I've heard of the Cowles.
They
had that's where
no
they sprung from.
Down there to speak of it all, you know. Des
Moines. Oh, it's a little. Des Moines, a little city, 180,000 at that time.
Yeah.
And here they catapulted themselves into this great, gigantic news media that they've got today.
Yeah.
Well, the first big move that they made out of Des Moines was taking over the Minneapolis Star.
Yeah.
The Minneapolis Star was
all three independent papers. Yeah. Took them over, just like that.
But the one they moved on first that we did was the Star.
Yeah, yeah.
They were down on across from the old General Hospital.
Well, that was originally the Central Labor Union's paper.
That was when the old socialist mayor, Thomas Van Leer, started it.
Yeah.
That 1921-22.
Yeah, yeah.
But
he started earlier than that, 1916, plugging for a daily paper, and it took him years to do it.
Yeah, but I mean, wasn't the Star launched in about 21-22?
That's right.
In the Switchman strike, in that period of time.
Yeah.
The Metropolitan Dairy was on strike.
That's right.
Huh?
Yeah. I remember. That was after the Metropolitan Dairy. That was in 1911. That was way back. They crushed that.
The old man got beaten that one, my stepdad, and he got beat again in the 1917 strike when Gil Plagman sold out.
Yeah.
You see, and that's when he had to buy horses and go into contracting business. There was nothing left for him to do. When Thomas Van Leer...
The milk wagon drivers was the one that crushed the Metropolitan Dairy. They put them out of business completely and set up the Franklin Cooperative Union. And they finally went under the Northwestern National Bank.
Mm.
That's their worst opponent in Minneapolis now. Franklin Cooperative Creamery. Still called that.
It's still called Cooperative Creamery?
But it's a cooperative. Yeah.
It's not a cooperative anymore.
No. Hasn't been for 30 years.
They were beyond the cooperative state when we were in politics.
Yes, sure.
They were big business then.
That's right. Yeah. Hmm. But they were for us in the strikes.
Yeah.
The milk wagon drivers.
The milk wagon drivers per se.
Yeah.
Franklin Cooperative Creamery per se.
They
hated our guts.
Yeah. They hated Tobin too, though. You see, that they held that against them because they took in the inside workers, the milk, and brought a butter business. And they had a fight with Tobin, and they never forgot it.
Well,
they were for expanding the trade to the trucking business. They were for that because that helped them. You see.
But to round out the story on the Star, they weren't going to sign a contract with us. Well, we were determined that if anybody in the city of Minneapolis signed a contract, it was going to be the Minneapolis Star, because they were the people that sprang that bastard 500 local union.
That's right.
With Cliff Hall. They had all the renegades in town down there on the payroll.
Yeah.
What year was it?
Oh, that was 35, 36. Yeah. Now wait, we were back in the AFL. This was in 36.
Yep.
It was before we got back in.
Yes, yes.
It was one of the blows. We had that big fight down there.
That's right.
And that was one of the things, because Bill Brown took Fritz Snyder and myself and Elmer Hansen. Mm-hmm. And Cliff Hall had his office down there when Jewel, Mickey's wife, was working for Roy Weir.
I know.
In the Central Labor Union.
Yeah.
And that Fink, Bill Rathbone, drove the car.
Yeah, that's right.
And this big piano mover from Boyd's, from LaBelle,
yeah.
Merrill Van Tassel.
Yeah.
And Fritz went in, and
time I heard his name for so many years, I'd forgotten about it.
Well, we beat that guy up to that floor. That Central Labor Union was as red as that carpet, because he tried to struggle with Fritz and I.
Yeah.
And we give it to him. And Cliff Hall climbed up on the bench, up in that desk he had, out of sight, and we says, "You son of a bitch, we're going to give it to you too." And he started screaming. And who was that little guy? John Bosco. He come and he says, "I'm the president of the labor union." Well, we're pounding on this Van Tassel. We're about to be influenced by, what do you call it, see?
Yeah.
And Pat Corcoran and you and Farrell were up at 257.
Yeah.
And you remember how mad everyone was? You give me and Fritz hell. But we didn't know. Bill come and got us. He says, "Come on." We says, "Where?" He says, "We got Van Tassel down the Central Labor Union."
Well, who was Van Tassel?
He was one of the Fink drivers that went with the 500 Union.
Nice.
See, when we got expelled out of the Teamsters Union in March of 35, it took a while before Tobin chartered a new union.
I see.
It didn't immediately happen.
No.
Because they figured we were going to die a natural death.
Yeah.
Well, we set up the policy committee. We started helping everybody. We were wheeling and dealing. And we were growing,
uh-huh.
And Tobin figured he had to do something.
Uh-huh.
So he imported a bunch of people from various places. Them two Italian hoodlums from Chicago, and Joe Bellini,
yeah.
Nick Wagner, Bob Hahn,
yeah.
Leonard Murphy from Rockford.
Yeah. Yeah.
And to make the organizer, Cliff Hall, he set up a local union first.
Yeah. Yeah.
With Cliff Hall as the organizer and business agent, and Babe Nolan, and that gang from the Star as trustees. You remember Babe Nolan was one of them.
I know. They had to have seven men on their executive committee.
They picked them out of the Star.
Start out with that.
Picked them out of the Minneapolis Star.
Uh-huh.
And because they were thought that they would be able to hold their own.
And this is before you organized the Star, huh?
We had them organized.
You had them organized already.
Yeah.
Split.
And they sneaked away on us. They got a handful of Finks down there and wrote a yellow dog agreement. So we were determined that the Star was not going to go.
Mm-hmm.
And they had too. Remember, they had their trucks with gravel screens around the windshields and everything else. Oh yeah, they were
ready for trouble.
No, they weren't ready for trouble, but they were running from it. They weren't ready. We were ready. They were running. We were the ready boys them days.
They didn't know what to make of it. They didn't know what to make of it.
Then when over to LaBelle, they went to LaBelle.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Dick LaBelle today is one of the big prime movers of the Allied Van Lines. He's not the organizer of the Allied Van Lines, but he was one of the big wheels in it present day.
They're still operating.
I wouldn't know anything about it. LaBelle was one of the big outfits.
One of the big companies.
Uh-huh.
And he's now one of the big directors. Dick LaBelle, the son of the old man, is one of the real big operators. He was the president for a long time.
Yeah.
And
It was mergers all the time. With
the Allied Van Line had a particular setup. Yeah. Well, they got these transfer drivers and these newspaper drivers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this Merrill Van Tassel, he was big. He weighed about 280 pounds, and he hardly could get through that double door there. But he was just as yellow as the Swedish flag. You know? He just didn't there. And he made the mistake of trying to fight Fritz and I in the office, and Elmer Hansen, the three of us.
Yeah.
He couldn't handle one of us alone, and here the three of us were on him, and John Bosco was throwing his rank around, and Jewel was in the office screaming and hollering. She didn't know what was going on. And when we came back up to the labor union, Farrell and Ray had been talking with Pat Corcoran. That's when the amnesty began, didn't it?
No, it began when Corcoran called me. and said that he's got something and he wants to talk to the leaders.
Yeah, but I mean that was the period when there was a kind of a period of amnesty there. There was gunfights on the streets, yeah. And you and Ray were, that was a civil war. You remember you and Frozy got dumped one time?
Yeah.
We were all up on Washington Avenue there, and they started shooting at us.
Yeah.
And we all crawled under cars but Arne Johnson. And remember, he got shot in the ankle and hit the concrete.
I got an awful beat.
George Frozy,
he got the worst of it.
Yeah, at the Omaha Freight House.
Oh, geez, they pretty much killed him.
And then a couple of nights later, Ray Rainbolt and I and Ori Norton and George Frozy, we had them corralled up in the Sheridan Hotel.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So here come some private bulls. They were in plain clothes. And Frozy, just a couple, 3 days before, had been beat up, and Ray, they had their heads all bandaged up yet. And Bruce Vincent had a Buick, just the same kind that the police were driving, the same model. And Bruce Vincent was on their staff at that time. So this is a bunch of plainclothes cops come up. And I happen to know one of them, his Sibbett. He used to stand on 7th and Hennepin. I knew him from the years when I was driving for the Dayton Company.
Yeah.
And I says, George, it's the bulls. George says, I don't give a goddamn who it is. They ain't going to beat me up the second time. And he started shooting.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was the bulls.
It was the bulls.
Yeah.
So then we started to run, see. Well, I had the gun that I had. I threw it in Ray Rainbolt's car. And Ray, he beat it. And Frozy had a little 25-20 Colt automatic.
Yeah.
And when they got us in the alley,
yeah. Yeah.
Frozy still had the gun. And Mickey made up a poem about it. You remember and put it in the organizer? You'll find it in the organizer yet, if you got the old organizer.
How'd the poem go?
Oh, something about John Brown's body. Frozy was trying to throw his gun in the garbage can and all that. All that Mick could write things.
Frozy got put in jail that time, didn't he?
I did too.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, we had a hell of a time to get that one squared.
Yeah, yeah.
Huh? No. You don't shoot a policeman and get by with it, Joe.
No.
Isn't
that the one that Farrell squared?
Yeah, Farrell squared that one. Well, Farrell, not just Farrell alone, but I mean, you know, but Farrell was the end. And he got them two guys that was going to be the complaining witnesses on a boat out in Lake Michigan at the time of the trial come up. And the district attorney was a little provoked. He had no star witness.
Yeah.
And the case was dismissed. I think Poyer was in on that act too,
yeah,
wasn't he?
Yeah.
Judge Poyer?
Joe Poyer, yeah.
Joe.
He was a judge then.
Yeah, he was judge then.
Yeah.
He was Olson's chauffeur one type almost.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a lot of things went on those days, right?
Those were rough days.
Oh, but they were fast.
Yeah.
Yeah, you see, the story has never been really told.
Oh.
Well, you couldn't do it. It probably isn't worth doing it now.
I'm not so sure.
There's so much of the things that will be different the next period. It'll be a good thing, all right.
Yeah.
It'll be a nice thing for the historic record, all right.
I'm not so sure it's going to be too much different.
We're
entering a period now where the capitalist system is fighting for its life.
That's right. That's right.
And once the revolution begins to spread in other countries,
yeah.
And they turn back into the United States and start attacking the American working class, they're going to be fascist gangs and hooligans and thugs,
sure.
And you're going to be fighting all of them all over again.
Of course you will be. I understand that all right, but I mean that will be so much the you won't reach back for another 50 years to find out about.
No,
that'll only be done after you make some gains.
You'll have to play it by ear.
Yeah,
at the time.
That's what you do anyway.
Yeah, that's what
we
do
anyway.
What did we do in Minneapolis? Same thing.
Take Trotsky's History of the Russian Revolution. Read it carefully. That's what he observes. You know, when he was writing his book, he wanted to get with statements that workers had made in the thick of the fights, or things they remembered, and. He says, you know, he gives an explanation for why he doesn't have from the rank and file. He wrote a book when he went to all the enemies of the Bolsheviks and from the Bolsheviks too, to show there were two sides to it, all right. But he deplores the idea, you know, and deplores the fact that there is little that comes from the workers, because he said, when you're in a revolution, He said the muse doesn't sit on the shoulders of men who are active. That is, they never make the record, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
That's
then,
true.
Then a average
and
worker
only
man,
somebody with a memory like Jack here could go through it.
Yeah.
There's 9/10 of what you say here only comes back to me now.
Yeah.
I have long ago forgotten those kind of things.
Ray, you remember the morning we were down to Strutware? Well, one of the mornings.
Yeah.
The morning that you got the hell beat out of you.
Yeah.
Remember?
Yeah.
They had the bulls lined up. Poor Skogie.
Yeah.
They had the police. Ray had already been, you were in the paddy wagon in the hospital that, by that time.
They surrounded me with six or seven cops on a stairway where they had a door between them and the street. And they used their clubs, not this way, they just jammed me with the end of their clubs around my belly, and they broke 3-4 ribs next to my backbone here.
And that's the day, there's another.
Just by punching me with the club.
There was another
piece. I passed out, they threw me on a table.
There was another piece of Farrell's ingenuity.
Oh yes.
That
those
afternoon,
those kind of things happened all the time.
That afternoon, we had the defense guard called in, and everybody that was a captain in the defense guard, for the most part, was a truck driver.
Yeah.
So Farrell got a hold of everybody he could, and everybody he could send out to contact people, and everybody was to drive their truck, regardless of where you were, drive your truck down there and create a traffic jam about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and that's exactly what happened. Every guy went down, semis, straight jobs, big trucks, piled out, took the keys with them.
Yeah.
What can the police do?
Where at?
Right down the heart of the city.
Yeah.
On 6th Avenue South and 6th Street South and 11th and 12th Avenue.
Yeah.
No, 9th and 10th it was.
Yeah,
right off of Chicago Avenue.
Reached up to 6th
Strutware.
Avenue part of the city, yeah.
That was the Strutware, what do you call it?
Were you on strike down there?
No, but the hosiery workers
were. We were defending them. Stopping him from moving out of the city.
I see.
So what happened that afternoon, we figured they were going to have to do something, so that's the morning they dumped Ray. So in retaliation, we were down there. And everybody that could get a truck down there, I was working for the union at the time, so we didn't have any trucks to drive. But we were down there. So everybody come up and they parked their truck. See, pretty soon there was the police were blocked off. They couldn't do anything. Because here there's these big trucks. You couldn't push them. 15, 20 ton of freight on some of them, nothing on the others, but they were there.
Yeah.
No keys in them. How are you going to move a Big Mac truck? It's standing there. Huh? Where's the driver? I don't know where. I don't know. Nobody knew nothing. See? And they got these finks in the plant. And what are we going to do with them? We got to get them out. And what did they
let
do?
Let them out.
They got all the cops they could muster, you see, but they couldn't come down because of this barricade of trucks and cars and everything. Mm-hmm. So they decided they're going to march them up 7th Street. Yeah. You remember that march?
Well, that's 7th Street to Dayton.
Right up to the Dayton Company.
The biggest...
biggest department store in town.
Yeah.
And the biggest fink in town.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was contributing more money than anybody. He went to church on Sunday morning and he prayed. And he went in the basement of the church of the... Redeemer, and he donated $25,000 to equip the special deputies in May of 1934 to break our heads the next day, and it didn't take. They got their heads broke. But the funny part of it was, this was months later.
Now explain it. They were marching the finks out of the...
Well, they had to get them out of the plant.
Yeah, they had to get them out of the plant.
Yeah. See, in the morning, in that morning, they dumped Ray.
We sent him
Ray to the hospital or the jail, I forget which one. We heard about it. That was in the morning you got her.
Yeah, I got
early in the morning when the shift was going in.
Yeah.
I see.
The shift was going in that morning.
I wanted to get the picket line closer to where they were going in. And I said, come on, we had to go through a hedge.
You were back a block from where we were.
Yeah.
And at that time, they used
to... They separated me from the rest of them, and the cops got a hold of me and took me into the building, you know.
And they worked
That's where they worked the hold of me, in the building.
And they had a line, a block down on the other end. This was a big plant. It was a block, in a block square.
Uh-huh.
The city block square. It was a big plant, 6-7 stories high. Strutware Knitting Company.
Uh-huh.
And, it was an old Prussian Dutchman runner, John A. Struthers.
Yeah.
And he was strutting, too. Before we turned two on him. But anyone you look back, it was laughing. It was serious then. And what they done, they had assembled the fink someplace else. And they brought them in on streetcars that morning. And the streetcars were double headers. That is, one streetcar pulling another. They were like interurban trains.
Yeah.
They brought him up to the corner, and they had him lined up there. Yeah. And the cops were standing shoulder to shoulder, and they all had a nightstick. Yeah. So we were all standing out there, Harry DeBoer and myself and Fritzy Snyder and Carl Skoglund and Henry Schultz. Yeah. And we said, well, we're going to have to do something. We can't let them finks get in. So we went out, and we says, what's the battle cry going to be? Well, we didn't know what. You had to have some signal. One guy can't charge alone.
Yeah.
So we says, the next fink that smiles, we'll charge him, just like a football deal. Well, Skoggy didn't know about it. Harry DeBoer and I and Fritz Snyder and George Drion and somebody else, we made this up.
Yeah.
And Skoggy and Stultz and Henry Schultz were standing there, you know. And here come one of these finks. And we made the point that we'd go, we'd take it next to this sergeant. That Frank Bleed was a sergeant, because he didn't have a stick. He says, when the next fink that comes to him and smiles, we'll give him the business. So we hit them line, and these bulls weren't prepared for us, the four of us. And we charged him, and we clobbered this one fink, and we ran. Well, the police couldn't break ranks, and they didn't dare shoot, because they'd shot into the finks and the crowd, and they didn't have orders. Well, they'd already got a hold of Ray and beat him up, take him to the paddy wagon. So then Farrell started organizing the defense guard, and the truck started piling up, and everybody coming out and plugging things up. Well, about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, they were faced with the problem, what to do with these finks.
Yeah. Yeah. Streetcar couldn't even get through.
Yeah, the streetcars could. That was all. They were down a block.
I see.
We didn't block the right-of-way of streetcar. Mm-hmm. But we blocked every other avenue. And the only place was open was 7th Street. So we, of course, we can only speculate what the strategy was. But it turned out that our speculations was correct. They figured they'd get all these finks together, 300-400 of them, surround them with all the police they could get, and march them uptown and turn them loose in the rush hour in the city.
That's right.
We didn't know where they were going.
We
found out before it was over. And down the street they went. And we right behind them and on the sidewalk and everything. And you see, they didn't have enough cops to keep these guys surrounded like a hen and her chickens.
Yeah.
And at the same time, pursue anybody that clobbered them. So you'd run in and clobber one of them finks and get back in the sidelines again. The cops couldn't do nothing to you. Because the cop had learned something in 34, that if he got lost in that crowd, he didn't get up. And that wasn't too far back, was it, Rick? If you'd have seen that day at 34, all them guys laying there. Because the cop's got a uniform on. Everybody knows who he is.
Yeah.
And you're just a working stiff. Everybody's got different clothes, see?
Yeah.
The cop stands out like a Negro in a crowd of white people, see? Everybody's after it. So we started. Well, when the police got up to 7th and Nicollet, they must have told these people where to go.
Get inside.
Get inside, and they all ran into the Dayton Company. And we right behind
them. They followed right in, yeah.
And we
wrecked that goddamn store.
We just about tore that store apart. If it wasn't for the finks in there, most of the guys were veterans of the 34 strike.
Yeah.
And they remembered old George Draper Dayton.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And they done a little job on him. And a lot of them went out the door with some stuff they didn't bring in either.
He was a wild thing.
Well, once the finks got into the store, how could you tell which one was finks?
Well, you didn't. You just clobbered anybody. You just hit anybody that was handy, because the law of averages is going to protect you. You're going to get one of them.
They did everything.
Yeah. And they were screaming and hollering. But you see, you asked a question now. Now, the way it struck me and a couple of more, I think, the fink knew we were after it.
Yeah, he'd run.
He was screaming.
Yeah,
and the people that come in, they were startled.
They didn't know enough to run.
Yeah, they didn't know what was happening.
So he
kind of marked himself, and we give some of them some awful beatings.
Oh, yes.
Oh, that was a terrible thing.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Did they come back to work the next day?
Of course not. They closed the plant up.
Well, the plant threatened to move.
There's another story.
We stopped them doing that, too.
But you remember how we stopped them that day when they were moving with the U.S. Marshals? They were going down someplace in Missouri.
Yeah.
They couldn't get a trucking company.
They were going to move to St. Joe.
That's right. They couldn't get a trucking company in the city of Minneapolis to put their trucks down. They tried for months to move out. And we said to the trucking company, you want to take your trucks down there? Fine. How many are you going to need? 6 or 7? Oh, that's all right. But that's the end of you in the trucking business. Because there won't be another man drive one of your trucks in this city again or any place else. So they brought some U.S. Marshals in,
They had to go down to La Crosse, Wisconsin.
That's right. They went 110 miles in Mar to get trucks.
Yeah.
And they were some Army surplus trucks or something.
Yeah.
And they had a siding.
But
down
who was driving them?
United States Marshals.
Yeah.
United States Marshals.
Yes, they couldn't get nobody in the city to move them out. Here was a company that had closed its plant.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Closed the plant. They were selling out. They were threatening to move to St. Joe, Missouri.
That's right.
And they were months. They couldn't get moved.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, they beseeched somebody, and they got the hold of the United States Attorney General, and he sent in some marshals. And they got two truckloads down.
That's right.
And they were down there on that old Milwaukee sidetrack on 3rd Street by Skellett's Warehouse. And we couldn't get at them, and we couldn't find nothing to throw. And somebody, here come a milk wagon. Remember that?
No,
and
I
we went.
That wasn't good.
We went in and we got these cases. That's the days they used to peddle milk in quart bottles.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, you take a 2-pound quart. There's 2 pounds in a quart of milk bottle,
yeah.
And you get behind it and give it a heave,
yeah.
And it hits somebody.
Yeah.
Jesus, it hurts you just like a brick.
Yeah.
And down they were coming. We threw away a whole load of milk that day. But that ended the marshals moving that outfit out.
Yeah.
Hmm?
You threw the milk at the marshals.
We didn't have nothing else to throw. And here was a guy on his route. He was peddling. And some guy come up with the idea, Jesus, let's get them milk bottles. And away went the milk bottles.
That a nice handhold.
Oh, you can let them go, they'll go like a football. Some of them, the top flies out, and you lose.
Weren't the marshals armed?
Sure, but they couldn't shoot.
Yeah.
Who's scared of a gun? They'd use guns on us in Minneapolis.
Yeah.
Huh? Yeah. We figured guns are only dangerous if somebody's shooting them. You can carry them around forever, they ain't going to hurt you. Huh?
Well, they couldn't get anybody else to drive either.
They couldn't get nobody to move.
See, the marshal is not supposed to drive a truck, you know.
Yeah.
Not supposed to do anything. He's supposed to get somebody,
guard.
And he ordered him to do it.
Yeah.
But the guy that he ordered to do that, they tried that. They had him in a garage over there.
Yeah.
And Bill Brown and a few others went over and told these guys, you want to drive that truck, you better get out here and join the union. And they just left him and told the marshal, I'm not going to drive this truck anymore.
They brought the trucks in?
Yeah.
They couldn't even get a truck.
No.
They couldn't rent or hire or buy a truck in the city of Minneapolis. Because the minute we had an espionage system in Minneapolis in those years that I don't believe an employer could go to bed with his wife without the maid calling us up and telling us about it. Huh?
Yeah.
Gee, that was something. Hmm?
Knew everything was going on.
Well, if we didn't, it didn't take us long to find out.
They always had somebody that was bringing information.
That's right. We had a key, somebody, someplace in every spot.
They'd go through, they'd wait until the bosses left, and they'd go through the wastebasket and pick up letters, or letters that had been started at some little errand or something. They'd pick up the carbons of it and stuff like that. Come down and show us what they were talking about.
Sam Oleski,
yeah.
Was the president of the Minneapolis Transfer Association. And I used to work for Minneapolis Van and Store.
They brought down a lot of useless stuff, but they were with the union, you know.
Art Spooner and myself used to go down to Oleski's office at night.
Yeah.
Art Spooner was one of the road drivers.
Yeah.
And Art would call me up and he'd say, come on. And we'd go down and go through the file. If there was anything in there, we took it.
Yeah.
We made copies of it.
Yeah.
Art would keep his truck because the road drivers used to come in all hours of the night and day.
Uh-huh.
You'd probably be coming into New York or St. Louis or someplace.
Uh-huh.
You always had to have a key. So you used to go in and read Oleski's correspondence. That was the Minneapolis Transferman's Compliance Association. And we knew what their plans were lots of times before they got them off the drawing boards. Hmm? In addition to all, like Ray says, all the other information.
Yeah.
But we knew what was going on.
You see, in broad terms, you know, you can say that those strikes were more popular with the 90% of the civilized people in Minneapolis. That's a fact. They were for the strikes.
That's right.
With these 40,000 unemployed workers.
Yeah.
They were for the strikes.
Well, look, Ray, look at
the
money.
Not there to, they had to go to great lengths, go out in the country and get country people to come in, you know. And they were scared to death, just like these scabs were in that knitting factory, stocking company.
Yeah, Strutware Knitting Works.
Strutware Knitting Works. And they didn't know what to do. They didn't figure out anything like this, you know. They were useless to them.
Remember that big guy, what was his name? Alex McEwen from Pittsburgh. He
came
in there when they won that strike.
Yeah.
At that time, there wasn't anything that he wouldn't have done.
No.
And he couldn't understand. Nobody was around with a satchel looking for $20 bills, really. He couldn't understand it.
Yeah.
We were all down to Jack Davenport Saloon there one night, and he was telling us, what kind of breedy cats are you people up here? He said, how come? He says, what's going on around here?
They didn't understand.
They didn't understand that people were in the there. Yeah. And you talk about during the strike, when we used to take the organizers out into the taverns, the reception that that paper got indicated the way the people in Minneapolis thought at that period of time.
You could put those, you could put the little tins with it they got up around any bar you wanted to almost. Whether you had a certain few bars that you wouldn't put them in. But every bartender was behind it.
Everybody.
And he was getting not a dime for that paper. He'd get a dollar bills and stuff them in the cans.
They'd turn all the money over.
All the money. They were just dead set on it. And they had people that they knew in the strike, you know.
Well, look at the girls. Ray, you remember in the stockade?
Yeah.
The landladies from town. Mm-hmm. Well, by and large, it was a married man, junior. But the landladies used to come out to the stockade with money and cigarettes and everything for the boys.
Sure.
And that wasn't the source of their trade. There were two or three of them that come out there all the time.
Yeah.
You know, it reached that level, which you normally don't get.
Landladies.
Yeah.
You mean the ones who are keeping boarding house and so forth?
Prostitutes.
Oh, prostitutes.
Yeah.
Oh, why do you call them landladies?
Well, that's what they were. They used to call them landladies, the madams.
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
There was
the
three
madams.
Or four of them used to come out of there.
Yeah.
They hated the cops, number one.
Yeah, they hated the cops.
Hated the cops.
Of course. They were persecuted by the cops.
And the Jewish underworld, the bootleggers, they all hated the cops.
Yeah.
Everybody was in favor of that except the top flight of people. That's all.
And they couldn't understand.
You had nobody that dared to go in and think on you very long at
that
time. No, sir.
They couldn't understand.
They were speechless. They never hollered. They never boycotted. They never did anything like that. No. You never saw anything like that.
It was a phenomenal thing.
Yeah.
Tommy Banks, who by his own standards was against everything we stood for, yet was one of our great allies all during that period.
Of course.
Tommy Banks, who was he?
Number one hoodlum in the city.
He was the kingpin
of the syndicate. Him and Kid Can and a few
and
more.
Kid Can,
they were.
He was a Scotchman, Tommy Banks.
Tommy Banks was.
He didn't drink. He didn't monkey around with anything. He was a sportsman, a gentleman if you ever saw one. But he used to call them the Hebes, that is the Hebrews. Those were his people.
That's right.
And
Izzy
they
Wolk
worshipped him.
Izzy Wolk and a few more?
Yeah, they worshipped him. And he turned.
Well, how did he help the strike?
He helped it in every possible way he could.
Money, influence, pressure,
anything. He kept us from going to jail. Farrell and I went to see him.
And you couldn't get money?
We couldn't. Even John L. Lewis's check was returned for bail for us when we were in John L. Lewis's union.
Uh-huh.
And I said, I think Tommy Banks can fix this because they had out in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, he and Olson had set this thing up.
They set up the bonding company.
Oh, this was in 40.
Bonding company to get the bootleggers out.
This was in 1940.
Yes, but he played a role in 34.
Yes, and all the way through the strikes. He was a friendly guy.
Yeah, he was friendly.
And all these people that worked under him, they were friendly to us too. You know, they were not scabs. They hated the cops too.
We done Banks some favors.
Well,
when the bootlegging was going on and the alcohol was being run, and we knew
naturally we wouldn't look at that kind
they
of
weren't
stuff.
They weren't factors in the trucking industry.
No.
They were hauling sugar out and alcohol back.
No,
so many a night I would go, Farrell would say, or someone here, two or three of us that knew what the score was.
Yes.
We was escorting this truck up.
Yeah.
It didn't hurt us. These guys weren't interfering with us.
Well, he opened together with, what was his name, the only Jewish organizer we had?
Mo Hart.
He went to him and got the keys to a couple of junkyards where we could get pipe to saw up into weapons.
Yeah.
In the middle of the night, brought him down to.
Yeah.
That was in the first.
614 First Avenue North.
No. They brought him into the first. They brought him into 1900 Chicago, in the May strike.
Yeah, I'm talking about.
That's right.
But during the night, you remember we deployed the thing, so we were sitting there in the morning.
That's right.
We sent Carl Keene down there about 2 o'clock in the morning.
That's right.
That was, see, the big beef come on Saturday.
They opened the yards and gave us the pipe. orders? That was the orders from on top.
The big beef come on a Saturday morning at the Beerman Fruit Company, yeah. And we got a beef. Mm-hmm. And over Sunday, what Ray's talking about now, over Sunday, that was the town was shut down, is when they opened up the yards, yeah. And that's when they started. Mm-hmm. Sunday, they started manufacturing the weapons for the fight that was coming on Monday.
That was the Battle of Deputies Run.
No. The Battle of Deputies Run took place on Tuesday.
Yeah, that's
we fought the Harness Bulls on Monday, yeah. And that's a very important thing.
Oh, that's the time when you jumped in among them.
Yeah,
that's right. You were telling me about
it. Well, we sent this guy down, this...
Bell.
Yeah,
Bob Bell. What was his name? Yeah.
Bob Bell. He drove the truck.
He was the guy you were saying was 6'9"?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, he was a tremendous man. He couldn't go through that door.
Right, so... And he drove the truck.
He drove the truck with about 20, 25 men in it, yeah. And it said on the side of it, rid the city of finks or rats.
No, it was my idea. Rid the market of rats.
Yeah.
Even small rats are dangerous. Yeah. Something like this.
But what kind of rats are dangerous?
Well, all rats.
Well, even
all
rats are dangerous.
The bigger they are, the worse they are. But then, you see, during the night, we got the story that Gamble Rob was going to run.
Yes. Yeah.
The day before Saturday.
That was the biggest outfit.
Yeah. Saturday had used Beerman Fruit. Yeah. Beerman Fruit was the second biggest company. Yeah. Gamble Rob was the biggest. Because yeah. They operated, they were the Pacific Fruit and Produce.
Oh, yeah.
So we deployed everybody down into 614 from about 2 o'clock Sunday night on.
That was the basement of the Central Labor Union?
Yes, and we were in the basement, upstairs, all over that.
They were just a block from the market.
Right around the corner. Yeah. Right around the corner. And that was on 1st Avenue. The Gamble Rob barn was between 5th and 6th on 3rd Avenue. It was two short blocks,
yeah.
Real short blocks. So come daylight Monday morning, everybody was in the market. And come about 5 o'clock in the morning, the cops started to show up,
yeah.
And about 6:30 or 7 o'clock, they were all assembled. And along about 7:30, down come the truck. And the Gamble Rob brought three trucks in that morning. And down come the truck, and the signal was, let the trucks get in. When that truck gets in, that's it. So everybody had something in their hand openly, and up their sleeve, and down their pants leg, and under their coat, something else. And the cops thought they were disarming us out in the street.
Yeah.
And the minute he says, now you sons of bitches, we'll show you who's running things around here, fall back there. So we all fell back a little, and just about that time the truck comes in, and all hell broke loose. And when the smoke cleared away, there was about 35 bulls laying stretched out, their cars was upset, and they were hauling it for any place they could get.
Yeah.
They couldn't go and pick up the wounded policeman in the street. They didn't have the guts to do it.
They deserted each other. They were panicked.
They went. They left. And that guy that used to stand on the corner of Groveland and Hennepin, that big cop there, and used to give you that stop signal halfway down the hill and then come over and give you a ticket. I think every guy down there that could go over kicked him.
Yeah, and I heard guy in the early part of the strike saying they knew that guy was a good guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. They learned fast, though, in the strike.
Yes, sir.
The beating we got the day before was enough for them.
And the next day was the Battle of Deputies Run. And boy, these police learned something that morning. They learned to stay the hell out of the way.
They let the deputies fight that day.
Let them fight? They deserted them.
Yeah, they just deserted them. That's all.
They just plain old truck driver's language. They just hauled ass. They got the hell out of there. I see them walking down to Carl and Einer's saloon and hiding out and everything else.
Yeah, yeah.
Huh?
It wasn't no more. I heard Ori Norton tell some of the youth the other day, you know, a story about, and it was right too. He was, he chased one of these goddamn guys. He jerked his badge off me. They tried to jerk their badges off and threw them away.
Threw them away.
So it wouldn't be identified.
Uh-huh.
So he found a guy that had jerked his badge off, and he caught him up near 1st Avenue North and 7th Street. And he stopped him, you know, and he had a club in his hand. And he was telling these kids, you know, he said, an old woman came by, quite an old lady, and she said, is that one of those deputies? And he said, yes, ma'am, that is. He said, I ought to straighten him out. She said, the best way is to swing that club, laddie, swing that club.
And so he did.
So he did.
Well, that was the Battle of Deputies, right?
Yeah.
That was on Tuesday.
They just got out of there.
Oh, the police left them. Yeah. And they made big comment about it, the newspaper and everything else.
Yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh. About how they'd been deserted.
Yeah.
And they pled to old Sheriff John Wall, you remember?
Yeah, yeah.
About the pitiful lack of defense that the constabulary had offered the citizens.
Well, you see, the cops didn't want to be monkeyed with that way. You know, they were made to look very bad. They
had ridiculous.
Plainclothes people to come down and help them out.
Yeah.
And they were sore as hell at that.
Well, they were sore more from what happened to them on Monday.
Well, of course.
And then the loss of their prestige and pride.
They didn't want to take the beating. Besides,
they didn't want seconds.
No.
Huh?
They didn't want
I called Farrell yesterday, Sunday, and told him I was coming down here and I was going to look you up. And one of the guys that just got killed here in an automobile accident, L.B. Thomas.
Yeah.
Was one of the guys that sat in judgment on John Mahoney, rooting him out of the Sabres Union.
Yeah, I know that.
So, it so happened that the three guys that led the strike in Minneapolis, and my old boss Joe Cochran from Cameron Transfer, and Wakefield, that guy, you know, and Lyman, and Pillsbury, they were the four. Lyman and Wakefield.
You're talking about Arthur Lyman that got killed.
Yeah.
Well, he was the attorney for the Citizens Alliance.
Yeah, but
he
I'm
was
also
a rich man, a very rich man.
You know, the name now slips me.
I don't remember any of the other guy that was killed. I don't remember his name.
Well, there's another one there.
He was the head of the.
The guy that got killed in the street was the head of the American Ball Company.
That's right,
Arthur Lyman.
Ball, yeah.
He was killed.
Yeah.
But I was thinking of the guy that come down there in the polo hat and the jodhpurs.
Well, that's what I'm trying to think of, but I don't remember.
But that isn't the guy that I have in mind. The guy that got killed with the hit in the head in front of Beerman Fruit Company.
Yeah.
It was Arthur Lyman.
Yeah.
The other guy's name was Peter something.
Yeah, I know, but I forgot.
Yeah, and then the guy that come down there that led them guys in, that led the Citizens Army in, it wasn't Lyman, because he lived. He's the guy that had the polo hat. And I'll think of his name in a minute, Ray. One guy's name was Wakefield and John S. Pillsbury, Jr.
Well, Pillsbury didn't get hurt very bad.
No. But I mean the incident, how it occurred.
Yeah, yeah.
They were one of the prime movers.
That's right. Yeah. Well,
Joe Cochran.
Among the big millionaires.
Flower Company. Yeah. Joe Cochran died a terrible death. He was the chairman of the Employers Committee.
Yeah.
Well, I don't place much faith in the Lord, because he never was on hand to fill the flour barrel very much, you know. But some people rely on him. And Joe was the head of the Citizens Alliance, the transferman section.
He was their spokesman.
He was not the head. Strong was the head. Ray Strong, but I mean, he was the titular guy during this strike.
We're renting from Strong now.
You are?
Our headquarters, yeah.
You can be sure and keep the rent paid, huh?
He said that's the reason we got it, because we always paid our rent.
You're renting from Strong?
Yeah, we're renting our headquarters from A.W. Strong.
The same Strong, the son of the Strong?
Well...
Or is it the same?
It's family.
It's our family. The Strong Scott
he
manufacturing
owns all kinds of property.
And they're,
and they're in the real estate business for rental or anything else, you know.
They used to be a big manufacturing company there, machinery and so on.
Well, he made all the steel and the cog wheels and all the big shafts and everything else for the flour mills and the sawmills before that.
Strong Scott Manufacturing.
Yeah, Strong
big
Scott
heavy
Manufacturing.
Here's Scott to think, Ray. He might like the idea of running to you.
Mm-hmm.
He might like the idea of running to you. He knows who he's running to.
He knows who we're running to. Well, of course, he told us outright. We know who you are. Of course we know Dunn. But I was on the committee that went down to see him. Carl Feingold and I. And Carl said, "What the hell? You're kind of a goose chase. You leading us on here, Ray." Well, I said, "He's already said that if they read our pamphlet, who we are, where we come from, they want to know that we're the same people that we were used to be." And that's what their official said. And he was a nephew of his Strong.
Uh-huh.
Schultes, his name was. And he was a fascist thinker, if anybody I ever met. And he came back and told me he'd gone to the top. And they said, "Okay, we've checked your record and you've paid your rent." And he said, "That's all we need to know." So then they started to write the contract for us. They objected to certain things. Some things we got, some things we couldn't get exactly. But we got almost everything we wanted. Hmm. And we've been there 7, 8 years. Will be 8 years next January. That's right, 8 years. We've got a three-year contracts. Hmm. We've never had any trouble with anybody. We got the place that is one of the most perfect things you ever saw. Right on 7th and Hennepin.
Yeah, sure.
704 Hennepin
Street, next to the old Pantages Theater.
We're in the theater.
Up above Max's Hungarian restaurant.
No.
Well, Max's used to be on 7th Street there.
This place is developed, you know.
Yeah.
There's next to it is one of the finest theaters in town.
Yeah,
it's
I know.
It's the same building.
Yeah.
And down right below us in the front is on the street level, on the corner, is one of the biggest musical distributors of these kind of records. They're the Tops in Minneapolis.
But I mean years ago, Ray.
Oh, well,
years ago, Max's Hungarian restaurant used to be across the street from the Schubert Theater.
I know that.
It was a real real place, something like Sheik's.
Well, the Schubert Theater is when they organized the Coal Yard Strike.
Oh, I remember.
Yeah, very well.
I handled that one too, right? But I was going to say what happened to Joe Cochran.
Yeah.
Joe Cochran was quite a party boy. So one night after the strike was over, a year or so later, he was driving one of the company cars, and he had one of the young ladies of the evening with him. And coming in from Oxborough Heat, which was beyond the city limits, and it was a sell liquor and thing, it was in the ice. He slid off the road and hit a telephone pole with the car. It was a steel top car. I remember when they bought those cars, I was driving truck for the company at the time. When they bought the car, they were 1933 Plymouths. And the pole collapsed on him and pinned him beneath the steering wheel. Remember Joe Cochran?
Oh, he laid
for 11 days and he couldn't do anything but wink his eyes. He was paraplegic, you know, before he died. He laid 11 days in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And the other guy, Wakefield and Pillsbury, and this guy, and for his name escaped me for the minute, that come down there in the polo hat, they were flying to Sun Valley or someplace in Pillsbury's private airplane to play golf. And they crashed over Nebraska. You see, so the latter led four of the stinkers in one bloody swipe almost. So I told Farrell, when I told him that Bodine died here a year ago, about a year ago now, and L.B. Thomas, I said, now John's only got two of them to go. And he says, who's that? I says, Harry and Gettings. So John is still going to be out to the graveyard, I think. He'll outlive them both.
Well, A.W. Strong is still alive.
He is.
Yes.
Well, Ray, he's 75 to 80 years old.
Yeah, well, I'm almost 80 myself, you know.
He's about your age.
Yeah,
sure. Hmm?
Yeah, sure.
Because he was 45 or 50 during the days in 34.
Yeah, I was 46. Yeah.
He had to be. Yeah. Huh?
Skokie and I were the old men, you know.
How old was Skokie? A little older than you were.
Yeah, 6 years older than I.
He must have been a big, powerful man when he was young.
Sure he was. So he got his leg hurt, you know.
Yeah, in the woods.
In the woods. He pretty near lost his leg.
Yeah. God, that was a pitiful thing.
That was before 34?
Oh, God, after he came over from the old country.
Yeah, he was about 17, 18.
Just after he created the revolution in the Swedish army.
What are you talking about?
I'm not talking no story. Carl created an uproar in the Swedish army when he was about 15 years old. He had some sort of a mutiny going over matches or some damn thing, whatever it was he told me. I'd have to think now.
It's quite common in the Swedish army then, you know. One of the reasons he came over here was because he didn't want to go in there.
One of that conscription. He didn't want any more of it.
He'd already been in the army, though.
He was in the army.
Sure he was in the army. He was a crack shot.
Yeah.
He made plenty of it. He was a very...
He's an amazing man. Well, this night I was telling you about Mickey and Grant, Clara, Fent. What's Fenton's name, wife's name? The one that worked at the Western Union. Lucille?
No.
I'm slipping names here now.
I would be too for the moment.
Estelle?
No.
Whatever it is.
Isabel.
That's it.
Izzy, we call
it. Izzy. So we come up there, Fenton and I and Skokie come up in Skokie's car. There's some friend up there,
Where'd you go again?
Up there to Crow Wing Lake, where we used to go fishing up there by Brainerd. So we got up there. We used to fish crappies. So I drove Skogie and Fent up. Fent was tending bar. That was in 1937. So Skogie rode up with us. And we get up there, and of course, Izzy was up there already, so Fent had a place to stay. And we get up there, and we had a few drinks, and everyone was talking, and Scarl was laying out there at the stars, and he was giving us an astronomy lesson, which he was able to do. Yeah. And it come time to go to bed, you know. Yeah. There's no place for Carl and I to sleep. And Mickey goes and gets some of them old hack driver's robes.
Yeah.
And we get up in this haymow, Carl and I.
Yeah.
And Carl had that old blue suit on, you know. You know how Carl would go. He'd sleep in his clothes.
Yeah.
Whiz up there. And it was a tin roof. It was, oh, God, when the sun got up, it was just like being in an oven, you know. And I got up. I woke up. The heat woke me up. And I can't see Carl. And I was laying on top of one of these ropes. And pretty soon I noticed something move. And I was a little, I didn't know, you see. And here's Carl. He had one of these old hack driver's robes. They were made out of buffalo hide, and they were lined with a heavy blanket. You know, the old hacks used to use them. And where this guy got them, I don't know.
It's kind of a sleeping bag.
Yeah, it would be the same thing. And Carl come out, and he'd been underneath this thing in that heat, you know. And I was stripped down just to a shirt and a pair of trousers, and I was perspiring like mad, and Carl had his blue suit on. And he says, my brother, yeah, it gets hot up here. There was sweat coming out of Carl.
What time did you wake up in the morning?
Oh, 9, 10 o'clock in the morning. The sun woke us up. See, we locked up the driver's club about 3 o'clock, and we drove up there. It must have took us an hour and a half, 2 hours to drive up there. And then we sat around and drank, and somebody was out fishing. Oh, a young Grant's, a couple of boys, Claire and Jack, were out fishing. All them.
These are terrible days. You had a lot of fun, though.
We did.
Mm-hmm. Had a lot of fun.
Yeah. Oh, you know what Lou Miller told me? I talked to him, too.
Yeah.
The police. The firemen are picketing the courthouse in Minneapolis.
Yeah, they have been for quite a while. Yeah. They were picketing them when I left them.
And the Teamsters are joining them. They're refusing to make deliveries.
I'll be darned.
Yeah, and they've offered them, according to Lou, I talked to him Sunday, they have offered them 7% wage increase.
Yeah.
And the firemen and the policemen says we want 20 to 25%
That's
or
right.
nothing.
That's right.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah, they're threatening to resign and everything else.
Yeah. Yeah, they're organized.
But they're not organized into a union.
Yes, they're in a union, sure. They call it a union, too. Yeah. They don't allow them to affiliate with anybody.
Uh-huh. They have their own union. Well, like here, they have the firefighters union, but it's not affiliated.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the Teamsters are supporting the picket line.
Well, so what did you tell me about this this outfit?
Honeywell.
Honeywell, they're out.
Honeywell's out.
Yeah.
And one of the demands is
remove
3 of the officials of the union.
Yeah.
It's 10,500 workers. Yeah. They rejected the contract by a 67% majority vote. That was 67-4, 33 against.
How long have you been out?
Well, I got the clippings to mail to Farrell. Lou sent them to me this morning.
Huh.
Right here.
Well, I'm sure tomorrow I should get a report on that.
Well, you got to go ahead and get ahead and reports ahead of me, because my spies are every place.
Well, I know.
Union faction demands 3 officers quit.
Yes, yes. I knew something about that before I left there.
Well, that isn't part of their negotiations, though. They're just demanding this alongside, at the same time that they're making demands upon employers.
I just had a chance to scan this. Yeah. But they have negotiated a contract with the union, the officials. And it concluded the negotiations. And they got the wrong kind of a settlement. They eliminated grade 11 or something, whatever that means. It's peculiar to the contract. And they went on strike. 67% of them went on strike. And one of the conditions is now that they demand the 3 officers resign.
The ones who negotiated the contract.
Yeah, which is a proper thing.
Mm-hmm.
Huh?
Sure.
If you don't bring us back to Bacon, boys, take a hike.
Of course.
Huh?
Legitimate.
Well, legitimate. It's the finest thing that ever happened.
Well, that's one of the better things I've heard so far. This
it's the best.
Yeah.
This beats This, you see, goes a step farther
than the machinist did even.
Than just the rejection of the offers.
Yeah.
See?
They rejected both their presidents and Johnson and
everybody. The whole bloody schmear. Throw it out.
Yeah.
Hmm? You see, there was
but
a
they
real.
They didn't demand that their officers should be replaced.
No.
No. This is a step farther.
Well, the officers are resigned. We've had a demand here, an officer resign. In fact, we voted one out. What happened is the next person that got the next highest vote steps up and takes the job.
Yeah.
But the idea that's healthy.
Well, it's the idea that's healthy. That's it.
You see?
Yeah, that has some meaning to it, you see.
Now, the West Coast electrician strike, they voted to reject the offers.
Mm-hmm.
They're standing pat. They've been out over 100 days.
Yeah.
There was a very, very interesting thing that happened here, which was played down in the Teamsters Union here last fall.
Mm-hmm.
There was a group of workers employed at the Safeway warehouse.
Yeah, tell Ray about this. It's very interesting.
These guys were, they're members of this big local over here, Contra Costa County Local 415.
Well, I wouldn't know what that
Well,
was.
You do know, if you'll remember, this was always a rebellious local.
Yeah.
There was the one that Casey never could dominate in the old days. And they've had their leavings around here, you know, there's some of them sentiment. Now, for the most part, they're a general driver's union, Ray, confined strictly to the city.
Mm-hmm.
They're not the long line drivers.
No.
But they do have a lot of these companies like Red Owls and so forth, the drivers going out of the city serving.
Mm-hmm.
They do have road workers,
you see. Yeah.
But they're not in the contract carrier or common carrier trade.
Mm-hmm.
They're all house jobs.
Yeah.
This local.
You mean house jobs? They all go come back to bar at night.
They all work for the company.
Well,
they're not in competition.
They call it local cartage.
Yeah. Well, this isn't even a local cartage job. It's a warehousing firm like Safeway.
You see,
and they go out here a couple of hundred miles to service the Safeway stores.
Yeah.
But I mean, they're not in competition like PIE drivers
or Skelton or Ballard or
Lebel.
I understand that.
So now this local has had contracts covering most all of the grocery wholesalers in this country, in this county, all the big stores. Now, instead of having them like we used to have in a group, minimum basic contracts, common expiration date, they had a hodgepodge. So they negotiated for the majority portion of these workers in this warehouse section. Now, they don't comprise the entire 4,500 man membership, but they're a good section of it, probably 1,400 men. So they had the most of them bottled up in the kind of a hoop-de-doo contract. It wasn't too bad as contracts go today, but there was a couple of features in it that the Safeway drivers and the warehouse men didn't like. The big thing was compulsory overtime. They were forcing the men to work compulsory overtime to the end that they were getting in 20 and 30 hours a week overtime. And it was just getting too much for the men. And it was compulsory and arbitrary in the part of the company. You're going to work overtime, bingo. So the guys, when the settlement, now remember, most of the local was at work, bedded down under a 3-year agreement. When it come time for the Safeway drivers, they bolted. They says, to hell with you and the boat that brought you over.
This was last year.
This was last fall, in about September or October.
Mm-hmm.
They bunched it. They went out on strike. They were out on strike for 2 or 3 weeks. Now the rest of the industry was working, and Safeway normally is a captive organization. You know,
mm-hmm.
They allow Wonder Bread to come in and put a half a dozen loaves of bread. They allow a milk company here, but most of their work, 90% of it, is their own brand.
That's
they push
right.
their own product.
Right.
So, during this period of time, Safeway opened up its doors. It allowed all these competing bakery companies, milk companies, meat companies to serve these stores, which was breaking the back of the strikes. In addition, they allowed other trucks than Safeway, like a contract hauler, to go down here to Punkinville and load up a load of canned goods and come and deliver it. So now the workers knew this, and they voted to reject the company's offer. And the Picards in the union were pushing it. They negotiated a settlement. The Picards pushed it, the men turned it down. They went on strike. They were out about 15 days, and the company made another kind of a bastard offer, and they rejected that by an overwhelming vote.
Mm-hmm.
And then they started to put the pressure on. go to appeal to Hoffa, demand a second vote and everything. Well, when the smoke cleared away, all of a sudden the Safeway people are back to work under a new agreement. Mm-hmm. And in addition to many other things, they eliminated compulsory overtime. They got a form of seniority which gave the older man the right to pick the easiest job. They got a little raise in pay above the other contracts that were into effect. And in addition, they got a complete drug and medical plan, which the others didn't have. Then the tune changed. The officials of the union, now heretofore that had been allowing all this skullduggery to go on, they started tooting the horn. Now we're going to push this contract and get it for every one of our 4,500 members. So apparently what happened, and I wrote to Farrell about it, that they appealed to Hoffa. But Hoffa read the sign and read it correctly. And Hoffa told them to get back in, muster, clean your skirts, get them fellows a little better than what they had when they went out, and don't come back with anything else. It had to be. Because they were all set. The Picards were chortling in the paper, you know that. They were going to appeal to Hoffa. Indications were that Hoffa would order a revolt. He didn't order a revolt. They negotiated a better deal. And the employers accepted it. Now, these are the kind of things that are happening, right?
I know.
Weren't you saying, didn't you say one time, Jack, that the Teamsters is the only union today that doesn't have the arbitration?
We have to qualify that a little bit. The basic and fundamental sections of the Teamsters Union under the direct control of Hoffa is absolutely against arbitration, and Hoffa refers to this as getting it from the Midwest Drivers Conference, which, if you date it back far enough, come out of 544. Mm-hmm. To hell with the arbitrator. Mm-hmm. Now, there are local unions that are not bound up in one of the national contracts.
Mm-hmm. That do have arbitration.
But all the national contracts and the official Hoffa policy in the Teamsters Union, arbitrate hell, we'll strike the bastards.
That's right.
That's Hoffa's words. Mm-hmm. And I can give you the Life magazine, shows the pictures, mm-hmm. I can give you the dates and you can go get them. Mm-hmm. Arbitrate hell, he says, we'll strike the bastards. Mm-hmm. And he gives credit.
I remember this because I included it as part of one of my lectures out of State College. And some of the kids, there were a couple of kids there they're the labor courses they have, what they call labor management courses.
Yeah.
And they were absolutely amazed at this. And they said they didn't think it was so.
Now, you have to qualify it in that respect. Now, one of the first things...
But if you qualify it, then it's generally true.
It's the national official policy of the Teamsters Union, to hell with the arbitrate, hell we'll strike the bastards.
Yeah.
There are agreements that are in effect that provide for arbitration. But under Hoffa's plan, to put them under national council form of negotiations and contract is the elimination of arbitrator. And when Hoffa took over the Western Conference of Teamsters, the first job he got rid of was get rid of Sam Cagle, who was the arbitrator for the Western Conference of Teamsters 4 years ago. And Hoffa showed it in dollars and cents, but it was costing the Teamsters Union membership to keep Sam Cagle as an arbitrator. And he says, I'll do the arbitrating if any arbitrating needs to be done. And this comes out of the first area agreement. That's where Hoffa got his school.
Yeah.
In 37.
And he knows its value, of course.
Of course he does. He's the power. Without it, Hoffa would have no power. They can talk all they want about Hoffa. We knew Hoffa when he was organizing automobile Holloway drivers. When we were organizing the freight drivers, you remember, Ray?
Yeah.
He and Bert Brennan used to come into the meetings and sit and listen. And we were the warlords that day.
Yeah.
And Hoffa learned.
That's right.
And he learned it clear that if there was an arbitrator muddying up the water or someplace, Hoffa loses his steam.
Yeah.
But the minute you start handling this over to the arbitrators, he approaches it maybe from a little different program than program than Ray and I would, or Farrell and I, or you and I.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But he understands its value, and I believe he's sincere in that.
Of course, he is.
Because he knows his power rests with him being the top dog, and only a people that have been in the Teamsters Union and seen it operate know the tremendous leverage. Now the day will come when the Teamsters Union, we won't live to see it, but the day will come if this present great keeps up, that the Teamsters Union will be something like the big railroads when they become the transportation monopoly in the country that the railroads were 50 years ago.
They're not going to do it that way.
No, but I mean, if it were to continue, I say.
Well, I say the railroads are going to be here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what I was trying to point out, Ray, was that the Teamsters Union today has contracts with literally thousands and thousands of individual trucking companies, where the big railroads unions have contracts with a handful of companies. The point that I was making, that if the transportation union of industry of trucks ever got to the status of the railroads, then maybe it would be a different thing.
You mean, see, at the present time, I understand there's like you say, thousands and thousands of companies, but isn't the process of concentration going on?
Yes,
consolidation?
Yes, but it's a tremendous thing. It's a tremendous thing, and it's so big that no one really can estimate its potential. I dare say that Hoff is probably dealing with 25,000 companies when he negotiates the national freight contract.
Well, and that was what the railroad unions were up against.
Yeah.
They were dealing with 150 different railroads.
Yeah, used to.
Now they're going to merge.
Yeah.
And they're going to be set up like they did before. The government is going to guarantee them profit.
The railroads.
Yeah, and they're merged the way they will be. They can have a railroad that will only haul stuff to the west, and stuff from the west will go to the east. They don't monkey with branch lines anymore.
Of course not.
The trucks will have that kind of stuff, but the trucks cannot and never can haul all freight as cheap as the railroads.
I didn't mean that, Ray.
What I'm saying is that the railroads will be here.
Of course.
Except they'll be more powerful. There'll be more money in it for them. They'll take the long haul stuff.
Yeah, and they'll take the heavy haul. And the truck driver or the truck will take the bulk.
That's right.
Which is the history of the union.
That's right.
Which is the history of the industry.
That's right.
And we had to know the industry years ago and when we got where we did.
That's right.
We had to argue them on their own grounds.
We guessed right.
Yeah.
Before old damn Tobin or even Hoffa knew anything about
it. Hoffa didn't know what it was all about at that time. He was still organizing them strawberry pickers in Kroger's warehouse at that time. And I'm not saying that in disrespect to him.
Well, he learned a lot.
You bet he learned a lot.
But one thing you got to give Hoffa credit for, he says who he learned it from.
Yeah? He don't back up?
He don't back up.
No, he don't.
He said he learned it from the radicals, and the radicals were right, at least in their organizing method. That thing at the little, you seen this little pamphlet that's been put out by the Jameses?
No.
Through the Bureau of Industrial Relations over there?
No.
Oh, I have to get you that. It's a brand new thing they just put out.
Is it any good?
It's a little interview with Hoffa.
Oh.
He gets his point of view on things.
Does he say anything, mention anything about the boys there?
Oh, sure he does. Sure he does.
Hoffa is the most popular trade union leader this country ever saw.
That's right.
Far more. Except for the short time that the old man that is now a millionaire with his coal people.
Oh,
he was popular during
John L. Lewis.
John L. Lewis.
Oh yeah, John L. Lewis.
Of course he was.
John L. Lewis was
a much more popular. Able man in certain respects than all people.
Yeah, but then there was
he was a hated bureaucrat in the AFL itself.
Oh,
the most hated guy in the whole AFL.
Yeah. Local autonomy, Outski.
I'll go get a copy of that for you.
Surprise.
I'm going to join you in my drink.
Well, you're going to drink what?
City water.
All right.
Who left the water running?
Radon left it running?
Well, that wasn't because I was drinking. I haven't had a drink for a long while. That was because I thought that Jack ought to have a drink of water.
Well, I'm not going to be like that. I swear a cube here and around. Hold, I'll have my drink too, Ray.
All right.
Hmm? Water.
See a man and take what he likes.
Aye, right, that's the wonders of this democratic society we're living in there. What does Dooley say about it?
I don't criticize anybody for what they eat or drink or who they love. Those are private things.
I see your hand, brother. God bless you.
You ready to think we ought to go to bed, baby?
Man of your word.
Oh, you're going to throw us out? No, you can do what you like. You excuse me, I had some mouth surgery.
Oh, I know that. I understood that.
You do know it?
Yes.
Somebody told you that? My secrets. I broke a tooth Friday evening. And today...
I think there was some remark made. I just...
Oh, for Christ's sake. Would you please erase that from your tape?
What a history now.
What did Ray have to say?
Ray who?
Sparrow.
Oh, he said he enjoyed that tape. Well, you know, the one you...